You had a chart that started in 539 and went to 515, and then underneath there would be another chart. It went from 515 to 415. So it's that second chart that you want to be consulting at this time. We saw earlier on that if the 70 weeks prophecy is to remain intact, we have to adhere to the traditional view, which is that Ezra returned under Artaxerxes I in 458 or 457. And that seems to be what the evidence would seem to indicate, that the order of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah would suggest it. Certainly, we can take the text at face value, and therefore we don't have a problem. That Nehemiah would be returning then in the 20th year of Artaxerxes I, 445, 444, as given in these scriptures in the book of Nehemiah. And I have suggested that perhaps the conditions spoken about in the book of Malachi might provide the background for explaining why Ezra made his request of Artaxerxes and then was given permission to go back, not just permission, but also instruction, a commission by Artaxerxes, not only to refurbish the temple, but to set things in order, religiously speaking, in Judea. I'm not insisting upon this date for the book of Malachi. It's quite possible that the book of Malachi could be put somewhere in this period, just prior to, or just after, rather, Nehemiah's return to Persia, when, after he had accomplished a great deal of straightening out of everything, that in his absence things went off the track, and that might possibly also be a time for the book of Malachi. But even if this is not the time period of the book of Malachi, undoubtedly some similar set of conditions must have been in existence in Judea for Ezra to have requested of the Persian king permission to go back and to accomplish a religious reformation. Now, what we want to understand is to see if we can come up with some answers as to why, at the earliest, it's not until this period that Ezra reads the law, and it's even possible that Ezra doesn't read the law until somewhere in this time period when Nehemiah has his second term as governor. And why we can see those three factors we were looking at in a different light. Because we saw that in Ezra 9:9, Ezra gives thanks to God for a wall. And then we saw that Ezra finds Jerusalem populated. And then we have the matter of Ezra living in the chamber of Yohanan. And that this seemed to represent problems because Nehemiah builds the wall, and Nehemiah finds Jerusalem depopulated. And Eliashib, the grandfather of Yohanan, is the high priest. But the big overall question is why the delay in reading the law? That's the number one big question that has to be answered. These other matters are smaller, but yet need to be addressed if we're to see a logical way these things could all be true prior to the time of Nehemiah. how Ezra could give thanks for a wall before Nehemiah built one, why Jerusalem would be populated at the time of Ezra's return and depopulated by the time of Nehemiah, and this matter of Yochanan's chamber needs to be dealt with. Okay, what, if anything, did you come up with your cogitations, meditations, reading, looking into commentaries, which is something which is fair game. Rarely done by students, but fair game. Be amazed what's in commentaries. Yes. Okay, I think that's very important, that he couldn't go about the reading of the law, as she said, without Ezra having some position of credibility. The people would be receptive to that. Now, and when we look into the account of Ezra's activities, let's see if we can make a diary for him, not a day-by-day diary, but major event by major event diary of what he does after he arrives. Okay, we've got him arriving in Jerusalem. What then happens? Based upon the events of the book of Ezra, what do we see happening? You have read Ezra chapter 7, I presume, and 8 and 9. It has been assigned for reading. Perhaps you need to refresh your memory. And? Okay, he immediately goes to do it, or does he do something else first? Okay. And he himself begins to mourn and fast and pray. And then, after that, he separates, and this is a very peaceful process. Or is it not peaceful? What kind of impression do you get from reading the text about the conditions in which this was done? Do you get any feel for the situation at all? The people make a covenant to agree to do what Ezra is requiring, but is it 100% enthusiastic, zealous compliance, or how would you characterize the compliance? Why don't you spend a little time reading through that process there and seeing what kind of a picture emerges? Because many answers are right there in the text if we just read the text. Yeah, because not only were they giving up their wives, but what else were they being required to give up? Children. They were weeping really very, very bitterly over this. Now, did everybody come forward on the assigned day and do what was required? Are you guessing or are you reading? Mike. Well, who has looked into the text and found out the answer, for sure? Kippy? Yeah, it took a long time. And did everybody follow through in this allowable time period of presenting themselves for this examination? What does it seem to indicate in the text? Or were there some that were a bit slow in showing up? So you're getting some significant, not just foot dragging, which is one part of the problem, and also bitterness over it on the part of the people that are going through the process. They're doing it, gritting their teeth and hating the thing, but doing it because they feel compelled by stronger pressure than they can resist. But you also have people actively setting themselves in opposition. Now, think for a minute. These don't just drop these women and children into a void. They leave the story, they leave the stage, they disappear, they're no longer in the play, we forget about them. They have to keep existing in some fashion. What becomes of these women and children? What is the only thing that is likely could have become of them since they've been ousted by their spouses? Of course. Can you imagine all these women and children coming trooping home? Well, what's this? My husband divorced me. And the crowds of these women. Well, what's going on? Well, we're not good enough to be married to them. You know, they got some zealous scribe in from Babylon and he forced everybody to get rid of their foreign wives and kids. This is going to create a great deal of an enmity and hostility in the surrounding nations. Now, how would you expect that hostility and enmity to be actualized? This is not hard to imagine. What would you expect these now hostile neighbors to do? Yes?
Perhaps they would have gone back and attacked the other people instead of just the population. Or the empire would have gone
to the population. Exactly, you see. And that's where we also bring in this matter of the wall. Because in the 70 weeks prophecy, it says, from, how does it begin? From the going forth of the commandment, what? Yeah, until Messiah the Prince shall be so many weeks. So in other words, Ezra, as he himself says, brought back permission to build the wall. That's why he gives God thanks for that. He's not, in essence, giving God thanks for a finished product. If you look carefully into Ezra chapter 9, verses 8 and 9, and let's read this carefully, you see he's giving thanks for a number of things. Says he goes all the way back to talking about the captivity under the Babylonians. In verse 7. And now in verse 8, he brings it up to the beginning of the Persian period under Cyrus. Now for a little while, grace has been shown from the Eternal our God to leave us a remnant to escape, to give us a nail in his holy place. For we were slaves, yet God did not forsake us in our bondage, but extended mercy to us in the sight of the kings of Persia to revive us, meaning to allow them to come back, to repair the house of our God, to rebuild its ruins, which has been done ever since 515, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. This last is not so much a fait accompli that he is already giving thanks for, because Ezra himself is the one that came back with that particular permission to build it. Now, because of this hostility of the surrounding peoples, that wall did not succeed in getting built. The people wanted to prevent them from prospering. Now, is there anything that we have not tied in to a specific time frame that would fit in this particular place at the time of Ezra, in this particular set of circumstances where the surrounding neighbors are very hostile to the Jews, very turned off, and they want to do them hurt and harm, and Ezra's starting the building of the wall gives them the excuse to do so? No. How would that relate? It's something we've already looked at and examined and studied. Dan? Remember that letter? Go back to Ezra chapter 4. Remember, the material in Ezra chapter 4 is not just a chronicling of the difficulties they had in building the temple. It's a chronicling of the opposition they received from their neighbors in the reigns of specified kings of Persia. But they were bad-mouthed all the days of Cyrus until Darius, and then in the days of Ahasuerus or Xerxes, they were bad-mouthed about something which we don't know specifically what that was. And then we have, in the reign of Artaxerxes, the same king who sent Ezra back, you have this letter of accusation from the surrounding peoples. Now let's look at this letter in a little more detail. Can you look on with him? Thank you. I forgot to bring my Bible. In verse 12, let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you, remember I said, I think in the King James, the regular King James says, from you to us, doesn't it? Are building the rebellious and evil city and finishing its walls and repairing its foundations. I'm reading now from the New King, I'm sorry, Revised Authorized Version, which I guess is the New King. No, is that, that's a different one. New King James, yeah. Now, I said we'd have reason to come back to that particular phrase. These people writing to King Artaxerxes are not just talking about the Jews generally. They're talking about a certain group of Jews who came up to us from you. In other words, people you sent. Well, it could, of course, be any group. But it's interesting that we know from the book of Ezra itself that Ezra and his group was sent by Artaxerxes officially. It could very well be referring to them. And are building the walls and repairing the foundations. Now, as a result of this false charge against the Jews, what is it that Artaxerxes decides to do? Let's go back to this again. Verse 21. Now give command to make these men cease, that this city may not be built until the command is given by me, until another command comes from me, in other words. Take heed not to fail to do this. Why should damage and increase to the hurt of the kings? And when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rechem, Shimshai the scribe, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem against the Jews, and by force of arms they made them cease. They made them stop building the wall. Now what is particularly interesting is that when you open the book of Nehemiah, it says in the second part of verse 1, it came to pass in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are in great distress and reproach. Now notice the next item. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and the gates are burned with fire. Is it reasonable that he is referring to the destruction of the wall of the city and the burning of the gates done by Nebuchadnezzar back in 586? I mean, it would be ridiculous to refer back to such an early event. It's obvious that they're referring to what has happened as a result of Artaxerxes' command in that letter in Ezra chapter 4. As Artaxerxes said, go up and make them stop building, use force on these people. You have permission to make them stop. I believe your allegations might be true, and I can't risk them building that wall. This is what is the referent, the antecedent in this mention to Nehemiah. So in other words, years later, approximately 12 years later, he gets this message that, you know, conditions are still as they were when the wall stopped and was forcibly stopped. And the people are now in even greater distress because they are continually suffering these raids because they have no protection. And this is what motivates Nehemiah to first pray about it and then ask Artaxerxes for permission to go back and build the wall. Artaxerxes says yes when Nehemiah asks him. Now, why does Artaxerxes first say no and then to Nehemiah 12 years later say yes? Well, there's two big reasons why he says yes to Nehemiah. We need to understand the big reason why he said no in the first place, why he listened to these accusations from the neighbors of the Jews. And if we're to understand that, we need to understand the larger scale of what's going on in the Middle East in this time period. That's where these dates become important. Okay, 490 BC is an important date in world history because a very important battle was fought then, the name of which you all have heard, whether you know it in connection with a battle or a more peaceful event. What battle am I referring to, Bill? Right, Battle of Marathon. This is when Darius had tried to conquer Greece and was rebuffed, the Battle of Marathon. Now, the reason the Persians tried to conquer Greece was not just because their desire for conquest was insatiable. The Persian Empire had tried to conquer Greece for a very specific reason. If we look at... I don't draw maps too well. All right. Here's the Nile River. Here's Cyprus. Here's Asia Minor. In this part of Asia Minor, you have a number of Greek-speaking cities under Persian domination. They are controlling these cities. The trouble is you've got the Greek peninsula over here, very poorly drawn, and these Greeks were giving assistance to the Greeks under Persian rule, stirring them up to rebel against the Persians. The Persians therefore felt the only way these people will be quieted down is if we conquer these independent Greeks. That will make these people quit rebelling. Consequently, the Persian Empire tried to conquer Greece, and in 490 they were defeated at the Battle of Marathon, and then in 480 the Greeks defeated them again at the Battle of Salamis. This battle was a naval engagement, which was followed up by a land engagement, which also resulted in a Greek victory. And this was in the days of Xerxes. And at this point, the Persians decided it's just not working, this attempt to conquer Greece. We're just going to retreat from that objective. However, what happened is that beginning in 463 and lasting until 455, if I have the right date, in 463 and 455, the Greeks began to go on the offensive. They had been on the defensive, defending Greeks against Persian attack. Now they decided to go on the offensive, and they began to stir up the Egyptians to rebel against the Persian Empire. So you might want to put in on your chart an arrow between these two dates and just label it as Greeks stir up Egyptians to rebel against the Persians. And throughout this period, Egypt was sort of like a pot on a boiling, boiling pot on the stove, constantly trying to throw over the Persian yoke. Now, that rebellion in Egypt stopped in 455, but it wasn't until a few years later, in 448, that the Greeks and the Persians signed a formal peace treaty in which the Greeks agreed to stop stirring up rebellion in the Persian Empire in exchange for a promise that the Persians would not attack them again. And so in 448, we have a peace treaty between the Greeks and the Persians, in which the Greeks agree to stop stirring up rebellion in the Persian Empire. Now, with that as background information, especially this material relating to 463 to 455 and this peace treaty in 448. Can you now see why, if in around 458 or 7 or 6, the Persian emperor gets a letter purporting to be from his loyal officials in Palestine, that the Jews are planning, once they get their wall built, to rebel, you can understand why the king would feel it's too risky to take a chance that this may be true. I mean, he may have thought, well, maybe it's true, maybe it's false, but can you see why he would have not wanted to take a chance on it? That he would want it stopped. Because after all, Judea is on the route to Egypt, and a rebellious Judea could block that route, which the Persian king must use to send troops and supplies to try to hold on to Egypt. Now, Egypt is a very wealthy area, and obviously he's not about to lose it from his empire if he can avoid it. So against this background of rebellion in Egypt, where he's really worried about losing Egypt, he obviously would be very sensitive to charges that Judea was likewise about to rebel. And indeed, the charges made in the letter, an even more dramatic charge than just the Jews are thinking of rebelling. But notice this in Ezra chapter 4, that in this letter, verse 16, again I'm reading from this revised King James, it'll be a little bit different. We inform the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls are completed, the result will be that you will have no dominion over the region beyond the river. They're not just saying that Judea will rebel, but remember, one of the things they said about the Jews is that in ancient times their kings ruled this whole region. That they will not only be content with their own freedom, but they will try to take away from you all the dominion in this entire area of the river, or stimulate rebellion by other peoples. And it is interesting that at this particular period of time, the Persian king Artaxerxes was having a, what does the textbook say? Who is the key figure here? Doesn't the textbook mention a particular satrap by name? Megabyzes. He's having sort of a struggle with it. Megabyzes is in a position as satrap over all of Avarnachar to tear the whole province away from the Persian king's hand, if he has a mind to. So you see, this is hitting the king where he's most suspicious, most worried. This letter was very carefully crafted to create the right kind of suspicion in the king's mind, so they would get the answer they hoped for. Now, think of the situation. Ezra comes back as a scribe full of zeal to accomplish a religious reformation for the purpose of securing God's blessings for the people. The people very reluctantly allow themselves to be talked into getting rid of their foreign wives and children. What follows? What fruit comes from that? A, the hostility of their neighbors. B, this letter of accusation against them, which means their neighbors now have permission to stop them from building their wall. If Ezra hadn't done this, we wouldn't have had this problem. Ezra is to blame. You can see how that would be the natural reaction. And so Ezra now has no credibility with the people. There's no way he's going to be able to positively motivate them to any other changes in their lives. They have seen their city attacked. They have seen the wall, which was so necessary for their well-being, destroyed. The city has, in a consequence, been depopulated because people don't want to be subject to these periodic raids. Their whole morale has been crushed, and they blame Ezra for all of this. There's no way Ezra can carry out any further work in these set of circumstances. Now, Nehemiah makes his request approximately 445 of Artaxerxes. Why would Artaxerxes give him permission to do what he had previously forbidden? Well, what's one reason? based on what we've already looked at. Joey? What would have caused the king to change his mind in 445 from what he had forbidden around 457 or 456? Richard? Right. Egypt is now quiet. Peace treaty has been signed with the Greeks. His disagreement with Megabyzes has been patched up. He has no reason to fear any of this possibility. Plus, can you think of a second reason why now he could contemplate giving a positive answer, besides the fact the international situation has quieted down? Joey? Well, that's still part of that international situation. Egypt is no longer in rebellion. He has the peace treaty with the Greeks. They're not going to, in the future, try to start any more trouble. Megabyzes is now, you know, the quarrel has been patched up satisfactorily. It's all the international arena. But what else could we construe in the mind of Artaxerxes why he is now influenced, you know, to be, see, yeah, I think I could safely say yes. Neil? Yeah. Because remember, as his cupbearer, Nehemiah is somebody who has already proven his tremendous loyalty to the Persian emperor. He has a very loyal, trusted servant who he is putting over the task. He's not worried about such a man starting a rebellion against him. Yes. Well, there would not have been a likelihood that a problem could have come without a wall. You can't rebel if you have no wall. Because then when the troops come, where do you hide? You see. But if you've got a wall, you think, well, I'll hide behind this wall, and they'll give up after they've laid siege to the city long enough. We'll wear, you know, we'll outlast the siege kind of mentality. That's why, as I say, they specifically crafted that letter. If you let the city be built and the walls be completed and the gates set up, then they will rebel, because they will trust in their wall to successfully rebel against you. So it's not so much the Jewish loyalty in this period. There would have been little chance for them to have been disloyal, you see, without the wall. Yes? Remember, Nehemiah was not just one of his most trusted servants. He also had to be a high-ranking administrator of ability. I don't think he would have doubted Nehemiah could have done that. I don't think so. I think he would have expected that this is a man who could probably do the job as well as a man I can trust to do the job. Not worry about it. Yes. Yeah, and now, of course, a stronger Judea would do this. Remember, too, that no emperor likes to have a province of his empire unprofitable. He could see that the reconstruction of Jerusalem was a key to the prosperity of Judea. He just didn't want to risk it earlier in the light of those charges. That's why he said, look, let this wall not be builded until another command comes from me. In other words, he wasn't saying forever I forbid it. But right now I can't risk it. Better an impoverished Judea and a loyal one than a prosperous, disloyal, rebellious Judea in the circumstances of this Egyptian rebellion. Yes. Okay, but remember, his main focus is not on Judea. He's got bigger problems at the moment. He's not so much worried about that. As long as they're not being disloyal and rebellious in turn, this is a small problem to be taken care of later once these larger issues have been successfully addressed. Yes? Yeah, well, that's what I said. I mentioned that. He's patched up his quarrel. So that another source of worry is gone. Now, what about these three problems? I think in these circumstances we've seen several things. One, why this letter we find in Ezra chapter 4 would likely have been written at this time. Why the king would have responded as he did because of these international troubles and forbidden the wall in this period and then felt free to reverse himself at the time of Nehemiah. because everything is quieted down and he's got a trusted servant to do the job. He's willing to reverse his command. We also have seen why, as a result of all these troubles that came on the Jews, Ezra has to delay in reading the law. He has no credibility in which to go forward. And it's not until Nehemiah can get the morale of the people built up again by giving them their wall and repopulating the city and otherwise restoring their well-being that the people are in a mind where they're willing to listen to any kind of further instruction. Now, what about these three things? We've talked about this already. To see that Ezra is giving thanks for permission to build a wall, this is the commandment that begins the 70 weeks prophecy. But it doesn't prosper at this time because of the reasons we've talked about. And now it takes Nehemiah's work to actually get it done. We've seen that the depopulation of Judea would have been, rather of Jerusalem, would have been a logical consequence of the attacks by their neighbors where they destroyed the wall and then were in a position to make periodic forays into the city that are referred to in Nehemiah chapter 1. They're suffering periodic raids. This would account for the depopulation between the time of Ezra and Nehemiah that Nehemiah would have to repair. What about this business of the chamber of Yochanan that Ezra is given to live in when he comes to Jerusalem, when Yochanan is only a child in this period of time? And the answer is that it's actually much more logical. You are, pretend if you're not in this circumstance, married, and you have a few kids, and you have a multi-bedroom house, and you have a distinguished guest coming in to visit. Now, assuming that one of the children's bedrooms was otherwise suitable, it's usually the kids that, you know, move into the sleeping bags and sleep on the living room floor, you know, when your guest is given the bedroom. That we've got that kind of a situation. And there is nothing in the text of Ezra that demands that Yochanan is the high priest at the time. This is what the modern critical scholars insist, that he was the high priest at the time of Ezra. But there's nothing in the text that indicates that. They're just engaging in wishful thinking, making him the high priest. Nothing in the text says so. But it's much more likely that he was just an individual who was moved out in order to make room for this distinguished visitor from Babylon. And so really this argument has no real strong weight. By itself, it has no strong weight. Now, continuing to see the end of this chart, Nehemiah has rebuilt the wall. Then in 432 he returned to Persia, and this is a guesstimation that in 428 or thereabouts he returned for his second term, because the Bible in the book of Nehemiah mentions he came back for a second term. It is possible that Ezra read the law at this occurrence, that perhaps Ezra was not even physically in Judea in this intervening period. That not being able to proceed, he didn't just sit on his hands in Jerusalem, but he might very well have gone back to Babylon. This is a possibility. And that Nehemiah, seeing the problems that have taken place in Judea in his absence, and if you read the book of Nehemiah again, you'll see that in this area of the book, which is in the hiatus of his terms of governorship, and while he was back in Persia, things began to go off track again. You find this in chapter 13, that it's talking about things that went wrong while he was in Persia. And beginning in verse 4. Now before this, Eliashib the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah and prepared for him a large room. Remember, we've gone over this before. During all this, I was not in Jerusalem. You see, while this was going on, I wasn't in Jerusalem. And it was during this period of time that the Levites weren't getting their portions either, and that people were buying and selling on the Sabbath. All of these problems had crept in while he was not in Judea. And so you can understand that he began to realize that just giving these people their physical security is not enough. They need to be gotten back on track permanently with a religious reformation. And so it is quite possible that he saw the need to have Ezra return, and now present for the second time as governor, he gets Ezra to read the law and get these things squared away. So as I say, I'm not insisting that this is the time period for Ezra reading the law. It is possible the law was read immediately after the wall was finished, but it seems to make more sense that since problems crept in while Nehemiah was gone, that the law had not yet been read, and that therefore maybe Ezra read the law after Nehemiah came back the second time. You can take that as you choose. I'm not insisting upon it in that way. Okay, let's quickly review this process. That in this period of time, the Persians have suffered two major defeats in mainland Greece against the Greeks in their war with them. The Greeks have counterattacked to create rebellion in Egypt, and the Persian emperor is suffering a serious problem with his satrap Megabyzes. In this context, when he hears from Ezra that conditions religiously in Judea are in a bad way, he is motivated to want Ezra to do something about that. Because remember, what is the principle of the government assisting local religions? What's the reason they do it? So that all the gods of the empire will bless their empire. Now, the empire certainly needs blessing at this time because of these problems. And so he sends Ezra back and also gives him permission to build the wall. But then he gets this letter from the neighbors, the neighboring governors, that say, hey, you made an error in judgment, king. If you let them build this wall, that's not going to be to your strengthening. That's going to be to your hurt. Go back and check the records about these people and what kind of people they are. And you're running the risk of these people rebelling against you. And so against this background of trouble with Egypt, the king decides not to risk it. And so he says, make that wall stop. So the people run up to Jerusalem and they forcibly destroy the wall. And as a result, Ezra's credibility collapses and no more work can be accomplished by Ezra. The city becomes depopulated. In 448, the treaty was signed with the Greeks, ending any possible problems on their behalf. And so in 445, when Nehemiah asked for permission to go back and build the wall, the king is ready to agree because the problems in rebellion in the empire are over, and he now has a man that he can trust and is also capable of doing the job. And so he sends Nehemiah back with authority to rebuild the wall. Nehemiah rebuilds the wall and gets a lot of the conditions in Judea restored to the way they should be. A lot of the religious conditions are restored. But unfortunately, in 432, he has to go back to Persia. And in his absence, things go wrong again. People begin to buy and sell on the Sabbath. Tobiah regains his influence and is given a chamber in the temple by the high priest himself. Lots of problems begin to result. Intermarriage problems start up all over again. See, everything is going off track. And so Nehemiah comes back again. He gets permission to come back again. And as I say, I'm suggesting that he recognizes he needs more than his own authority, his own influence. He needs a religious leader to get these people more solidly entrenched in doing the right thing. And so he brings Ezra back, and Ezra reads the law, and then Nehemiah gets the Levites their portions again. He stops the buying and selling on the Sabbath. They break up the mixed marriages again. And this is what I was referring to earlier. I've got these things mixed. The son of the high priest is a son-in-law of Sanballat, the governor of Samaria, and he refuses to give up his wife. And so Nehemiah says, I chased him from me. He chased him up to Samaria. And it is through this man that the high priesthood of the Samaritans comes. He became a high priest up there in Samaria, and it's his line which has come down through time. So finally things are now back on track, and Ezra has not only read the law, but he set up the scribal schools so they can continue to be educated in what the law means. They can continue to read the law every Sabbath and Thursday and Monday so people don't forget it, what they're committed to doing. You see, now they have some permanent institutions for maintaining the knowledge and the commitment of the people to keeping the law. Because not only will they hear it all the time, but they've got people exhorting them to maintain that commitment. In the same way, when we attend services every Sabbath, we are not only reminded of what God's way is, but we are exhorted by the ministry to maintain our commitment, and if possible, even to increase it, so we can be growing more towards the perfection which we're supposed to be striving for. So this is the mechanism that finally gets set into motion. Okay, we'll let you go.